to episode 14 of The Tangles, official companion podcast of BeneathTheTangles.com. I'm your host, JP, known affectionately, or not, online as Japes and Japesland.
And I'm your co-host, Sean.
This month marks the second episode of our new format, which I hope you've all been enjoying. As I mentioned last episode, we're always up for feedback, so please let us know how we're doing. With that in mind, let's get things kicked off with our announcements for the month. This month, we have two announcements. First, we're proud to announce that we've added one new person to our team, Emma, who will be our new webmaster. We have plans to redesign our site in the future months, and she'll guide us through the process. She'll also be writing articles, though, so please say hi if you get a chance to read one. Number two, we have a new column going up that'll be launching next month. It's right now untitled, but it'll follow Lina, one of our longtime writers, through her journey to Japan, where she's just recently arrived. And Sean will be introducing us to Otaku Diet.
Otaku Diet.
Well, while video game podcasts have a what we're playing section, and anime podcasts have a what we're watching section, since Beneath the Tangles covers more than just one medium, and The Tangles reflects that diversity, we decided to name this section Otaku Diet in order to include all types of otaku media, like anime, light novels, video games, manga, visual novels, and anything else applicable.
Well, Sean, it seems like this month we've actually been consuming some of the same things, haven't we?
Indeed. Packed up nice and tidy in a cardboard box, I'd say.
Well, if you did not catch that reference, just recently, Metal Gear Solid V, The Phantom Pain, perhaps one of the most hyped Metal Gear games, definitely one of the most hyped games of the last few years, finally dropped in stores.
Yeah, it's a little game. You may have heard of it. Hideo Kojima game. Konami didn't want you to know that, so I thought I'd give Kojima a plug on our podcast.
Yeah, as we like to keep Otaku Diet diverse, so this month we're going to be going with a video game theme. And we've both actually been playing it. So instead of each of us taking a few minutes to talk about what we've been watching playing, we're going to both share some of our opinions about the new Metal Gear game.
Gush. Completely unreservedly. Very few negative things that I have to say. I'm not that far along yet. I was talking to JP before the podcast. I think we're in about the same place. About like 24-25%. I'm about a little more than 30% done. But so far I've been loving every second of it. I did get briefly interrupted by a friend who bought me The Witcher 3. So I got a little sidetracked there. But everything that I played of Metal Gear thus far has been fantastic. I'm really enjoying the graphics and the Fox engine. The open world is a lot of fun. And 60 frames per second for such a big game is very impressive on the PS4.
Yeah, definitely. And for people who aren't as familiar with it, I'm sure most of you, if you're listening to this podcast, have at least heard of Metal Gear Solid. It is a very old series that goes back to, what, the 80s with the Metal Gear games?
They just had their 25th anniversary a couple years back. I think it's like 85 or 86 with Metal Gear for MSX.
Okay.
Which is a Japanese-only like computer home console entertainment system. So a little bit obscure, but they did port the older games over with Snake Eater, the subsistence edition of Snake Eater.
Right,
included
right.
Both of the older games. But yeah, it's been about 25 or 26 years.
It's, I can't remember the exact dates myself either, but, yeah, it's a pretty old series, and because it's both an old series, but one that continues to stay up with current technology, so you have, unlike, say, like, Nintendo's Mario games, which have more, I mean, they've transformed some, but they've kind of gone back to their original formula, and, you know, it gets prettier every game, but they stick with what works.
It seems like they've regressed back to the 2D era. Not that the 2D era was bad. It was actually fantastic for Mario, but...
Well, the reason I mention that is Metal Gear is, like, the opposite of that. It's a series that evolves, like, in just about every single way, every single entry. So we have... The Metal Gear games we have today are completely different from the ones we had 20 years ago, and even completely different from the ones we had 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, it seems like with Kojima, like you said, it's very it builds one entry to the next, and it iterates very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And the pattern that I've seen to notice with Metal Gear is there'll be a couple games that will have similar gameplay style, and then the next game will come along and will completely transform. You had the original Metal Gear, and then Metal Gear 2 Solid Snake.
Yeah.
And Metal Gear 2 Solid Snake, I mean, yeah, it was 8-bit, essentially, but it was a perfection of the gameplay in Metal Gear. And then you have Metal Gear Solid come along, and then, of course, you go from 2D to 3D. And it basically recycled everything that was great in those two games and transformed it into a three-dimensional game.
Mm-hmm.
And added so many more things and really fleshed out the codec system, had all kinds of crazy conversations, introduced, or I guess I should say brought back, those crazy supernatural twists and the insane plot points that everyone's kind of grown to love or hate.
Yeah.
In Metal Gear, depending on your predisposition. And then Metal Gear Solid 2 Sons of Liberty, I would argue, is a, you know, perfection of the 3D Metal Gear experience that was in Metal Gear Solid.
Not to mention depth and storytelling.
Indeed. But Snake Eater is completely different.
Well, it is.
I mean, some of the core, the stable gameplay is similar, but it introduced so many new concepts, like hunting animals, the outdoor settings, the wilderness, the camouflage.
So many concepts that no one ever uses.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But it's just, you know, like, I'll go back and play that game every once in a while, and I remember when I first played it, I never discovered this. And several years later, I went back and was messing around and realized, oh, you can actually trank a snake, then equip it as an item, then throw it at a guard, and if you hit the guard, it pops out and wraps around his neck.
What?
And does this elaborate anime. If it's a poisonous snake, it poisons him, and then he walks away and slowly dies. And
what?
You can use it as a stealth kill.
What?
And if it's not a poisonous snake, you can use it as a distraction because he throws it off his neck onto the ground, and then he kind of like does a snake charm dance on it and then stabs
what?
It with a knife.
What?
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah, see, I think JP may be discovering this for the first time.
I had no idea. But, well, what Sean is telling you right now is like, one of the defining characteristics of the Metal Gear series is just ridiculous gameplay stuff you can do. Like, I mean, this Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, brings like a whole new depth to the cardboard box.
Indeed.
Like,
as well as pooping horses.
And what is the point of that? Is there, can you do anything with that?
Yeah, it's actually really useful.
What?
Yeah, you can, in a mission where there's a convoy, if there's a jeep, it doesn't work on the bigger vehicles, but if there's a four-wheel, a military four-wheel drive, and you have to extract a target, if you can get out ahead of the target on the road and you make the horse poop in the tire tread marks on the road, then go and hide, when the truck drives by, it actually spins out, and it gives all the passengers whiplash. And you can actually, there's about a 25 to 30 second window where you can walk right up to them and they won't see you because their heads are just spinning in circles, and you can trank them or drag them away and extract the target without anyone even knowing.
Oh my gosh, I have to do this now.
See
what
would have made that mission a lot easier.
See, all right, and yeah, for listeners who haven't played this, like, my roommate has been watching me play this game, because, well, I don't have a PS4, and my roommate does, and I was like, I have way too much to do.
He
I can't be
the
playing,
PS4 off of it.
I can't be playing video games, and finally I was like, I really need to play Metal Gear, so I bought it. My roommate's like, sure, I barely use it anyway, you can use it. And he's been watching me, and so I'm riding my horse around, and you open up one of the radial menus, and there's just a command that says, do it. And so my roommate loves quoting Emperor Palpatine, and just goes, do it, all the time to me. And so he just sees it, and he's like, JP,
do it.
And I'm like, I have no idea what this will do. And then you do it, and your horse just poops.
The wonderfully realistic horse pooping sound effect.
It's ridiculous.
They may have authentically recorded that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Knowing Kojima, it was probably a must. They took a week-long vacation to a farm and recorded horses pooping.
Yeah, I mean, it's no wonder that Konami closed down his studio.
Stealth espionage excellence.
Anyways, so back more to the point. Yes, Metal Gear Solid 5 has, I guess you could say, its fair share of flaws, but man, it is the most fun I have had in a video game in a long time.
Some of the best controls and precision for an open world game I've played. That's always a problem I have with open world games, and granted, I don't play that many, but Red Dead Redemption was a big one for me, and I've also dabbled a little bit with GTA 5. I know a lot of people will be like, are you serious? But I don't really like the GTA series. I respect what it does for the open world genre, but I just don't like modern crime stories.
Yeah.
I just, this is not my thing. So, but I do really respect how huge the world is and everything that Rockstar does with those games. I love Red Dead because I'm a big Western guy, so that was like a dream come true for me. But one thing that is present in Red Dead and to a lesser extent GTA 5 is like really cumbersome controls. It's kind of laggy and it doesn't feel fluid. If you're playing, you know, a fighting game that's known for, you know, like a Street Fighter or maybe Tekken, it's known for precision and fluidity. And, you know, people are timing things down to the hitbox detection, and there's a whole metagame around that. Well, open world games, like, the attraction is the world. So, you know, you press the button 3 times and your horse doesn't show up, and then you glitch through it. Whatever. Yeah, you don't care about that. You're too busy having fun, like, wrangling prostitutes and dragging them through the city streets and fighting the sheriff, you know? So, but Metal Gear Solid 5 has that precision of a more traditional, non-open world Metal Gear game. Except you're in an open world. And that, to me, has made it infinitely enjoyable. Now, I run into the same problem I always run into in open world games. I never actually get to the story missions. I'm just, like, running through Afghanistan dressed as, you know, like, Mujahideen Snake with no shirt on and, a scarf and a rocket launcher just blowing up outposts and riding in from the darkness. And the thing that sealed it for me is I terrorized the outpost for a long time. And what I was doing is I was actually going up on the crags and headshotting them with a silenced rifle and just terrorizing them because they couldn't figure out where I was. And so after about 8 hours of doing that on and off, I actually rolled up to an outpost. And one of the guards, this is a paraphrase, he has a conversation with another guard. And he's basically like, "Have you heard about that psychopath? He's shooting everyone in the head." And then he could be out there right now. And I just put down my controller and I said, you know, this is why I play Metal Gear games. This is it right here. Kojima, you're just insane and I love it.
You know, to wrap up this this episode's Otaku Diet, I think you reminded me a little bit about some of the spiritual reasons why I play Metal Gear.
A metaphor of headshots.
I mean, no, I'm actually being kind of serious here.
All right, I'll let you be serious, JP.
One thing that I really like about Metal Gear is it always has a very serious moral. Like in Metal Gear Solid 1, I mean, there are a lot. They were all talking about genetics.
Destiny, but, nuclear deterrence. Yeah.
But one that was really easy to gather because they talked about it so much was nuclear deterrence and how terrible, like, yeah, nuclear warheads are, and the leakage that comes from it.
Right.
And in all of the series, one thing that they've always stressed is non-lethal methods. Now, Metal Gear Solid 5 does start to stray from that, because the theme of that is kind of like the fall of a great man.
Vengeance.
Yeah. It's like the fall of a man who used to be great, and now just is like living on revenge. But so it departs from that a little bit. But the games still reward you for not murdering, basically.
Sure, yeah.
And so that's one thing that is a stark contrast from something like GTA 5, which has some really awesome open world elements.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, it's like Metal Gear, it's like, yeah, sure, you can do what you do in GTA 5 and run through just guns blazing, mow everyone down. Or if you want more points, or whatever, or more money, or more guys.
Which is actually useful in Metal Gear Solid 5, because it was a pretty fleshed out base development system and upgrade system. So it's actually useful to be, you know, stealthy.
Yeah, stealthy.
Get all the guns that you can't actually use because you're sneaking.
Trank guys, knock them out. I will say, like, every once in a while I do go through guns blazing, usually after I've been found and I'm like, all right, there's just way too much here. I can't do anything.
You just roleplay. Yeah. You're like, I'm actually Snake. I just got spotted in a base of 500 people. I can't trank them. Like, yeah. Someone's going to have to die.
Yeah.
Did you, since you brought it up, sneaking in at the end of Otaku Diet here, did you hear about the hidden cutscene that they data mine out of Metal Gear Solid 5? Relating to nukes and nuclear deterrence?
No, I didn't.
Okay, this is a slight spoiler, I guess. Actually, no one even knows if this can even be achieved in-game, but people are right now out there trying to do it. But basically, there's a Metal Gear Online component called Forward Operating Bases where you can raid other people's bases.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the end-game things in MGS5 is that you can actually build nukes. You actually unlock the ability to build a nuclear weapon as part of the game. And then, you know, once the game's over, you can, I guess, just continue to build them if you have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just kind of farming your money and using it to build nukes. There's actually a cutscene in the game for MGO because you can use nukes online.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then, so that's kind of the end game of the single player, but the metagame for the multiplayer is nukes. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a cutscene in there where if every single person who's playing Metal Gear Online willfully disarms their nukes and destroys them. There's a cutscene where everyone in the world playing MGO has disarmed their nukes, and the game basically like congratulates you and says, well, we've all disarmed, you know, the nuclear threat is over. Yeah, and everyone at Mother Base is just kind of sitting there congratulating each other. So the fact that that's even in the game kind of, you know, puts the period on JP's point of, you know, non-lethal methods and that kind of quirky essence. So if you're looking for a great game that has a sense of humor but can also be serious while simultaneously ridiculous, then definitely check out Metal Gear Solid 5. It's been a ton of fun. I've sunk probably 30 hours into it, and I'm not even... Actually, probably more like 45, 50 hours, and I'm only 30% done. So I don't even know how many hours I'm going to waste on that game, but it'll be well wasted.
I am in the same boat. Well, I guess at that point we're going to move on. So last month we had the opportunity to interview for the second time Lauren Orsini of otakujournalist.com. Well, this month we had the opportunity to interview another blogger and someone who's been very involved with the Beneath the Tangles community, Tommy from Anime Bowl or animebowl.com. Let's take a listen. Well, for episode 14, this month's interview, we have the pleasure of welcoming Tommy of animebowl.com.
Hi.
Thanks for coming, Tommy.
Yeah, good to be on. I kind of begged to get on, so.
So before we get started too much into this interview, would you mind sharing with our listeners just a little bit about who you are, what you do?
Yeah, I'm currently trying to get into seminary, as I like to become a pastor in the Lutheran Church. And currently I am working through the beginning process of applying for that. So right now I don't have a job, but I'm trying to start the journey to becoming a pastor. And that's personally why I really love what you guys do at Beneath the Tangles and how you guys bring a spiritual aspect into anime.
Oh, so an aspiring academic, I see.
Yeah. Well, I have already gotten my undergraduate degree, but I'm trying to get that as well.
Yes, I gotcha. That's a really good goal to have. I admire you for it. So that's what you're currently doing offline. Tell me a little bit about your identity online, if you don't mind.
Okay. I started blogging in 2008, so I've been around for quite some time.
And even predating Beneath the Tangles, I might add.
Yeah, yeah. My blog is primarily an anime blog where I write reviews of the newest episodes that air on Toonami. But I also blog about football, as my favorite team is the Green Bay Packers. I love to blog about football, posts about each game from them, but mainly it's an anime blog. And sometimes my blog has some gimmicks, I like to call them, where I take a sports concept and I turn it into something anime related using anime characters or anime series. And those are my more interesting posts every year.
Well, that, I think, transitions pretty well into the basic topic of what we're following this episode, this month on episode 14, which is how the various aspects of our lives interact with our interests, particularly as relevant to the podcast, our otaku interests, anime, manga, video games, etc. So I notice when I'm on your website, animebowl.com, I see the very top big bold letters. It says Packers Toonami Conventions.
Yeah.
So I suppose, I mean, Toonami and conventions are a pretty obvious pair. But yeah, getting Packers in the mix there, that's a really rare, very, very interesting mix, I would say, for topics.
Yeah. And funny thing is, whenever I got into anime, I thought I was the only person to ever mix football and anime, and I never realized there was actually an entire anime series called Ice Steel 21 devoted to that, which I still haven't seen because I'm kind of a dub guy, and I can only find the subtitles of that. Yeah, but I never realized that existed whenever I made the blog. So apparently there's a lot more mix between anime and sports than I originally thought.
One question I have for you is, well, let me start just a tiny bit with me, is my personality, I'm very obsessive. I think I can say that pretty confidently, and especially if you followed my my column, Anime Today, on Beneath the Tangles, you know from my personality, that's how I tend to be. But that said, a lot of times my personal interests and hobbies are either connected to or stem from, like, whatever it is that is the object of my obsession. So I just have, like, a heart for Japan. Like, I'm obsessed with it, to stay with the same term. And because of that, I love anime and I love all these things that are connected to it. Mm-hmm. So one thing that kind of stuck out, you were saying you're kind of a dub guy. I'd say I'm more of a sub guy. That's is not worth getting into the argument, I don't think. But I think it shows a little bit of our diversity and interests. Like, I love Japan, so I've been studying Japanese, so I love seeing it in the original language. But you like the Packers, and you like Toonami, and you like going to conventions. So we're very different people. So now, that in mind, I'm really interested in how you have all these diverse interests. How would you say they all work together?
Well, a lot of the times they don't work together, and I have a completely unrelated football post in the middle of all my anime posts. But yeah, the way I try to get my interests to go together is, again, through these gimmicks I do on my blog, like my anime bracket. I've been doing that for, I think, 7 years now. And I take the concept of March Madness in college basketball, and instead I put in all anime characters. Uh-huh. And I put my favorite characters in there, and I see which one ends up winning. And I even offer a bracket contest where someone won the contest last year and won a gift card. It's kind of difficult to get things like football to mix into anime, but I found ways to do it over the years. And, another way, since I said I was a dub fan, I took the concept of the NFL draft and I made a voice actor draft where I would take certain anime series and I'd take which voice actors I think would fit best into that series. So it would work just like the NFL draft, but with voice actors. So it's a crazy concept, and it would probably offend the voice actors if they ever found out about it. If they ever found out about it, they'd be kind of upset. I got picked only 30th, you know? So, but yeah, it is. Those are some of the ways I've tried to mix my interest of sports and anime.
I find that really admirable, though. Maybe it's a bit of a stretch to say this, but I think in some ways that's kind of what we do at Beneath the Tangles. And I guess we could get into a whole other discussion on how that parallel does not work.
Yeah.
Football is obviously not Christianity, but
right. Yeah.
There's something about bringing your interests together or your lifestyle that really, I think, makes all of them the more fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to the other part of the discussion I'd like to talk about a little bit. Is do you do anything on animebowl.com that you would say brings your personal faith into your articles?
It happens from time to time. I sometimes call it selling out because I know that Charles is going to find it and put it up on his blog, which means I'm going to actually get a few more hits this time for my post. So, yeah, but I have found ways from time to time to mix my faith in. And I try to take it from a theological perspective, from a Lutheran perspective, since that's what I'm trying to go into. I'm trying to go to seminary, so I want to mix good theology into some of my posts from time to time. For example, I just last week I wrote a long article where I was on a rant about how people who blast the Dubs, who always blast the Dubs, saying that every single Dub is terrible, you know, how they are a lot like the people who say that the only version of the Bible you're allowed to read is the King James Version and nothing else. And so, yeah, I found a parallel between that because, you know, the Bible wasn't written in King James English. It was written in Hebrew and Greek. So if you're not actually reading the original Hebrew and Greek, you still aren't reading the exact, you know, the exact words that were written. So that's the same way that people who read subtitles think, oh, I'm getting the real thing. But really, they aren't actually translating the Japanese for themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a way, they're being a bit hypocritical by criticizing people for liking the English dubs of anime.
Mm-hmm. This is a tiny bit off topic, but no, I definitely know where you're going from. As an aspiring Japanese learner myself, I've gotten far enough where I can usually follow along. For example, when I was in Japan just this summer, I went to see Bakemono no Ko, or The Beast and His Boy, or The Beast and the Boy. I can't remember what the English title is. And that was totally in Japanese because it was in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I followed it okay. The Japanese I understood the best was the fight scenes, but those are the also the scenes where you don't need to understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
But before I got to the point where I could actually follow some degree of what they're saying, and I was purely reading the subtitles, I get what you're saying there. Like, reading subtitles, if you don't know any of the language, you get a little bit of the original, I suppose, because you're hearing it. But if you don't understand what they're saying, yeah, it really doesn't make a difference.
Mm.
But then again, I mean, when you're reading the Bible, some people prefer some translations over others. So,
right, yeah.
To each his own, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of conclude this brief interview, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your own podcast, something in case our listeners are interested, they might want to check it out.
Yeah. Our podcast is called the Anime Bowl Tsunami Podcast. And my friend Michael, who I've known for a long time, and I talk about the most recent weekend episodes of Tsunami. And, you know, we both come from a perspective of how, you know, reviewing and being quite critical whenever we need to. And at the same time, we find a way of making the shows entertaining. We started doing this, I think, back in March, and now we have 20 episodes. Because we do it every week, except whenever the episodes are on repeats.
Mm-hmm.
So our podcast is for Toonami fans, anyone who's watching Toonami and wants a critical perspective on how good the episodes were that particular night. We always pick our favorite episode of the night, although we retired that feature for a while because Kill la Kill was nonstop, always our favorite show of every night. Once Kill la Kill went off the air, now we brought it back again. So there's actually competition now.
Well, it sounds like you're representing a section of the anime community that Sean and I don't necessarily do a terribly good job of reaching out to. So, yeah, for our listeners, I'd recommend if you are interested in Toonami, interested in that type of anime, dubs, etc., check out animebowl.com and check out his latest episode, Anime Bowl Toonami Podcast.
Yeah, and if you think that Sword Art Online or Attack on Titan sucks, then this is the blog for you.
Shots fired. Well, thanks, Tommy, for being on today. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tommy.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks to JP and Tommy for that interesting perspective. That is a that's not a perspective that you'll hear come out of my mouth very often, and perhaps not JP's mouth either. So thanks, Tommy. That was great. We're going to go ahead and move on now with our new format and transition into the main topic. So taking inspiration from the stories and heroes in the media we consume was kind of the topic for last month's anniversary podcast. This month, we'd like to expand on that a little bit and go with the theme of media consumption and elaborate on that by asking another question, which is, why do we watch anime at all? Or I guess you could put it another way and say, what aspects of our daily lives, our personalities, preferences, and experiences shape our decision to watch anime and the genres and the types of anime that we consume? So we're just going to flip the coin over. Last time was more of how does media inspire us? And this episode, we're going to talk from the perspective of JP and myself, and also for all of the listeners, something to think over as you listen through. Why do I watch? What does it say about me? And how do I dictate, you know, what I consume and the decisions that I make? So how about it, JP? Well, why do you watch anime?
You know, I mentioned a little bit in the interview. I mean, I'm a very obsessive person. So ever since
Don't be so modest.
Ever since I first got into, like, any sort of otaku media at all, actually, but I had seen, you know, anime, like, growing up, like, coming home from school and watch the next episode of Pokemon. But I don't know if I really count that because I didn't know what it was. It was just cartoons to me. So it was
Chinese cartoons.
Chinese cartoons. Yeah, I love those Chinese cartoons. In high school was a chance I had to get into visual novels, which then actually got me into anime and Studio Ghibli. And then I just more and more watched more and more and then got me now. Now my interest is in Japan. It was kind of like the gateway to me. So I still love anime, but
the
it's
Ghibli
like,
threshold.
The Ghibli is like the gateway anime. And so now I'm obsessed with Japan, and it kind of dictates my career choices, my hobby choices, everything that goes around it. So to me, when I think like Tommy's passions are what? Christianity, football, and Japanese anime. Right.
Yeah, and specifically like Toonami and conventions, which is a very specific route. I have a lot of friends when I was in college that were into the convention scene. And I'm not saying they exclusively like this because that would be stereotyping, but they did like maybe like Big Three, or they liked more shonen-oriented stuff, colorful, bright, interesting. It's not something you'd necessarily see in American animation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that is a big draw. And that is a huge percentage of, I guess, the Western anime fandom.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
is
definitely.
That. I mean, it
definitely
consistently blows my mind when I watch videos from cons to see how big they're getting and how many people are participating. I think it's really cool because you know, anime used to be a lot more niche, especially like you look back in the 80s and the early 90s and you've got people, they get these elaborate communities to get the VHSs and they have to hard sub them. There's a couple documentaries on it that are actually really fascinating. But to go from that to having, you know, Aniplex and Funimation making all this money, streaming things online on Crunchyroll, and seeing the, you know, the anime community expand, it's really cool.
It is. And it's interesting to see, you know, people like Tommy, who I guess I would consider maybe part of that group. I guess I'm kind of part of that group too, but I feel like when I talk to people, my interests are different, because I'm, like, fundamentally a Japanophile, and not, like, a... I don't know. I guess I fit into the otaku category, but...
So it's like you're into the culture at large, you know, like the anthropology of Japan.
Yeah,
and it which just so happens to include anime.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that. I mean, I got started on anime, but I like to think that my interest is now inclusive of Japan as a whole, especially having been there, studying the language, career plans to go there again, things like that. So it's... I love hearing from Tommy and hearing like the difference and people who like some of the same things but for different reasons. And of course, then there's always the spiritual aspect to all that. I wouldn't write for Beneath the Tangles if I didn't consider that an important aspect of everything I do.
That's interesting. Maybe elaborate on that. I was thinking, I mean, I was going to bring that up, you know, whenever I talk about, you know, the reasons that I watch, but I guess the question I would pose is, do you find something innately more spiritual about anime than other types of media you might watch? Say comic books, Western animation, Hollywood film, foreign film, that sort of thing.
You know, it's hard to say for sure. I'd say one thing about anime is it's not afraid to address topics that especially American cartoons would never address. Things like Horo Musuko, or Wandering Son, is the story about the I think they're middle school students who have like gender. What is
that? Was that the transgender? And it was like a boy who is like a girl on a girl.
Yeah, there are transgender themes. The main characters are not transgender. They're just I don't know if gender confused is the official term. It's like they're
gender curious. I can't keep up with all of the proper terminology anymore.
They're anatomically male and female, but they feel like they're female and male.
Non-cis individuals or whatever.
I don't know what it is. You know, anyway, something like that. Man, when I watched that show, I had to spend a couple days afterwards just kind of like ruminating on like, all right, so what does this mean for me? Like,
what did I just see?
Yeah, yeah. Like, because it was really, really good. Sure. But it addressed a topic that is kind of hard to talk about. And then there's stuff like Now and Then, Here and There, which is just like the bleakest possible picture of the future of the universe.
Not to mention the art style looks like a child-friendly cartoon.
It does. Well, the first half of the first episode is a
child-friendly
cartoon.
And they set
you
up to think it's traditional shonen. You know, good guys win, bad guys lose, main character beats bad guys to death with a stick and triumphs, you know, but and it's kind of funny because it still retains some of that shonen ambition, but it introduces depth and complexity, deals with some really difficult issues like child rape and child slavery, child soldiers. I mean, topics that you hardly see addressed in, you know, live action films or foreign films, let alone what many people in America at least would consider a cartoon for children. And so, yeah, I think if that's the point you're getting at, I would definitely agree. That's also something that drew me to the medium initially before I really knew anything about Japanese culture. It's just something that I watched. I said, you know, this is different. There's some depth here. You know, there's melodrama and there's silliness, which is great relief from the more serious moments. But there's something more here that I'd like to investigate. And that was, you know, my entry point into Japanese animation was, wow. Not only is this from another cultural perspective and so exotic and therefore intriguing because I've never seen it before, but the maturity that exists in certain anime productions is fantastic, you know? And to market that at young teens, I think is also fantastic. I feel like there's this really bad tendency for people to sugarcoat when talking to children, especially like toddlers or young children. You know, you baby them, you baby talk them, you conceal the truth from them. And then young teenagers, or if you have a family, you know, we don't have the sex talk. We let them learn that in school. We don't want to deal with any controversial issues. We want to pretend like they're not there. A lot of people can fall into that. And I feel like anime is really interesting, and this may be a cultural thing, and maybe you have some more insight on this, but I feel like the Japanese are a lot more open when discussing the realities and the difficulties of the world to, like, young adults, young children and adults. They're a lot more frank.
Yeah, it's hard for me to say how much of that is a cultural thing because, I mean, Japanese culture, family culture, is so much different from Western. I would almost say that nowadays it's more distant, maybe. Like, the kids go to school. It almost makes me wonder if maybe it's more a reaction to, like, the lack of connection that Japanese people have in reality.
And so they project like that expression into their storytelling.
It makes me wonder because, like, think about Evangelion. Like,
oh yes,
Evangelion absolutely was what Anno's, like, his personal cure for depression was like that. That was him, like,
yeah,
him working through it himself, and then just sharing with everyone else, and then everyone else trying to find themes that maybe he didn't really intend. But it makes me wonder, and you know, that could explain some of the zany humor you see too. It's hard to say across cultures, and having not lived there for a significant amount of time, as in measurements of years. It's hard for me to say. But, you know, that said, too, that is not to say that these themes are completely absent from Western film, Western media.
Sure.
I just think it's a little bit trickier in the West to address some of the same topics. And plus, you have the entire... you have the separation from reality of animation. And there are certain things that are just easier to do in animation. I mean, pragmatically, it's cheaper
right.
to do certain things. But also, it's easier to show, like, child slavery
right.
Or child soldiers when
there's
they're
animated. There's distance.
Yeah,
yeah there's yeah. distance from, okay, this isn't a real actor portraying a real person. This is a story concept
yeah.
that we're communicating.
And so, yeah, something like Game of Thrones is a show I watched the first season, but I just can't do it. Like,
right.
it's just, it makes me cringe. Not just the sex, but the violence. Like, I can't watch it.
Right.
But when it's in animation, there's enough of a separation that you can consume the media, get the important themes from it, without compromising like your conscience. I think, much to me, like when you're reading a book, like reading the Bible, there's terrible stuff that goes down.
Yeah. Read the Old Testament lately, you know. Just open up to any random page in the Old Testament and skim around for a little bit, and you're likely to find some pretty horrific stuff.
Yeah. But it being, I think, in book form, and anime being in animation form, allows you to consume it, process it intellectually, maturely, without just being like, oh, boobs.
Indeed.
Well, oh man, I should probably take that back, because you know what? That's really not true with a lot of people.
I was going to say, you might be riding the white horse out in front by yourself on that one.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take that back.
And that's actually one of the big stigmas on Japanese animation. That was an issue I ran into when I was younger, wanting to watch it. You know, if I would express my interest in it, a lot of people, particularly the adults in my life, give me kind of these strange looks, and they'd be a little concerned, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they'd go on the internet and look it up, and all they would find is a lot of ecchi stuff or a lot of hentai stuff. And they were like, "Well, this is pornographic. This is horrible. You know, this is evil. You can't watch this." And yet, there are so many great things and so many great productions and films and series that have been produced mm-hmm. in the. I mean, how long has it been? The 50s or the 60s mm-hmm. when you really started getting, you know, Astro Boy and mm-hmm. Yeah. So many great things have been made in those decades that are worthwhile for anyone to see, that it would be a shame to throw it all into the trash because you heard some rumor about, you know, perversity or
yeah.
sexuality in Japanese animation. Like, you know, that element exists in all forms of media and culture, you know, for yeah. as many great works of art or Shakespearean dramas that you would see or fantastically entertaining anime productions, there's always going to be sex sells.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be someone out there to make a quick buck, you know, trying to capitalize on people's base impulses.
I do want to say just very quickly, because I'm rethinking through what I said, and I disagree with my own words to some extent. But I think perfect example of what I meant to say, at least, was you watch a movie like Grave of the Fireflies or something. Something with just a really difficult to address theme, like just the poverty that Japan underwent during World War II and the terrible, terrible effects of the constant firebombing done by the United States. Like, when you see all of the bodies, or another one, Barefoot Again.
Oh,
the,
man,
the atrocities,
that movie is rough.
Yeah, the atomic bomb. I could not watch that if that were live action. I couldn't get through it, I don't think. Like, I think I just turned it off because I couldn't watch it anymore. But the animation, I think it's enough of a separation that you're still, like, appalled by it, but you can still watch it and gather what you need to. So let me just go back and say maybe that's what I meant.
Well, it sounds like, you know, reasons for watching and, you know, and elements of, I guess, yourself, maybe be like an analytical aspect. Because
it could be.
You can, as you said, objectively consume it as a work of art or an intellectual treatise or a statement of, like, this was wrong, you know, and we're animating it and we're showing you some of the intricacies of what happened to express, you know, more fully the mm-hmm. message we're trying to convey.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing you kind of mentioned in passing that I bring back, because I know this is a big reason that I watch is the ability to create a world through animation with no seams or gaps, no fusion of 2D and 3D, no glaring special effects that draw you out of the immersion. If you have a team of proficient artists and you have a director with a vision and a unique art style or whatever the catch might be, you can craft an entire world of your choosing. It can be fantasy, it can be sci-fi, it can be sci-fi and fantasy, it can be noir, you know, it can be ultra realistic and psychological, or it can be completely zany and colorful and surreal. But it doesn't matter because it's self-contained. And whatever message you want to convey, you can convey it with 100% control over what you are showing to the audience. Because nothing's going to end up on screen unless somebody drew it and put it there, you know. And that's, you can't always say that with live action. You get your camera, unexpected things happen, actors ad-lib, people forget lines, the sun doesn't cooperate, you know. Sometimes that produces really iconic scenes, sometimes it leads to numerous reshoots. But bottom line, you're filming the real world, and the real world doesn't answer to anyone's demands. So
no human's demands.
You have to fit yourself into that and tell a story through that. But with animation, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're God. If you're the animator, you're God. You know, and there's the classic picture of the hand drawing the hand drawing the hand. And I mean, that's pretty much what it is. You are sculpting everything that is in that world. And I think that, for me anyway, is something that's very attractive. That ability to have a completely new perspective on the world that you live in by analyzing an alternate reality that you created to express the truths of the world as you see them. And just as a personal aside, you know, that is one of the big reasons that I continue to watch anime. After the initial, oh, this is foreign, this is exotic, this is really cool, you know, I started with some Ghibli stuff and it's very colorful and has very magical, especially when you're younger. It's, some of it is pretty magical even when you're older too, because, you know, Ghibli is very high quality on the whole. But especially when you're young, and if you've never seen it before, I mean, you're like on drugs, you know. It's like, wow, what is this? This is fantastic. Something like, I guess, like Howl's Moving Castle is something that I really enjoyed when I was younger because it was just so surreal and great, and it was its own world. But at the end of the day, that's just style. So was there something beyond the style that would hold my personal attention? And in my case, there was, because that world building and the depth of some of the stories, and, you know, to reference a specific, something like some of Otomo's work, Akira or Ghost in the Shell, some of the things that he directed, I should say. He didn't produce the original concept for all of them, but they create this insane technological but also supernatural, like, alternate future, but it's really the present because the year that they're set are now fastly approaching the year that we live in. And it's just like this you know, and it's like this little encapsulated sci-fi universe, and you can endlessly iterate on it. Like, Ghost in the Shell has had several series and several movies, and you can just keep refreshing it for a new generation because the themes are all there. And it deals with such a breadth of what's going on in society, what's going on in the psychology of the individual, what's going on with computer technology advancing and approaching the level of human intelligence, all themes that continue to be relevant, you know, as each day passes. And that perspective that can be achieved through animation, I think, is something really unique. The perspective and the control over the themes is something that brought me back again and again and again. You know, I was brought up very conservative, and I had a love of history, you know, whether that be church history or world history, the history of different nations and anthropology. And, you know, of course, I went through a period in my life where I started to question, okay, I was brought up this way, but do I really believe it? And so for me, after the initial, wow, this is great, of anime, this is so different, came the follow-up of, this is a totally different perspective. This is made by people on the other side of the world. And some of the themes are very steeped in Japanese culture. So it really made me take a new perspective on the world that I lived in. Like, there are other people doing their own thing over there. What do they believe? How were they raised?
That's, it's like spending any time abroad forces people to
Experienced that when you went to Japan, even more. You already kind of knew it, but then you actually went, and it was, I'm sure it was a completely different experience.
Well, and you went to China, I'm sure you went through the same thing too.
Indeed, that was quite the culture shock in the best possible way. And so I guess I would say that is a reason that I watched and continue to watch anime, because I view, to some extent, the consumption of media as a search.
Mm-hmm.
A search for truth, a search for identity, and anime is a broad and very interesting canvas.
Yeah. Well, would you mind, you just kind of got the gears turning a little bit. I know your interest in mythology. Could you expand a little bit more?
Dare we bring that up? Yeah, I mean, my interest in mythology, archetypes, and kind of meta-narratives and stories is something that was a long time. It seems to have emerged relatively recently, like within the past 3 or 4 years of my life. But really, now that I'm having a little perspective to look back, I see that the seeds were planted a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And the seeds were planted with the religious conservative upbringing and then the exposure to alternate perspectives at different places in the world, and then the interest in history to learn about all those perspectives, mm-hmm. because that naturally leads one into mythology.
Okay.
What's so cool about mythology is that it is the brainchild of people that lived thousands of years ago. If you go back to the earliest mythologies, you're talking like Epic of Gilgamesh or the Egyptian Books of the Dead, you're talking 4, 5, 6, 7,000 years
mm-hmm.
ago. Or longer, depending. I mean, there's alternate datings, but I mean, I won't get into any crazy theories about datings. Just a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And to dive in and pick the brains of people long gone by the stories that they tell, because nothing has really changed about storytelling from then to now. People still tell stories about things that are important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they may dress it up like a superhero or a god or a goddess, and they may make it extraordinary, but at the end of the day, a good story has at its core, you know, a very personal message.
Okay.
And so to dive into the minds of artists from thousands of years ago and see, you know, what was important to them? You know, what did their daily lives consist of? And what did their heroes look like? And what does that say about them? That, to me, is a great way to give some context to different religions and belief systems. To really get into the minds of people and say, why did they believe these things? Not all of the specifics and things that may or may not be right, but what was the original thought that brought about the creation of this belief system or this idea?
Yeah.
Because I have found more often than not that original thought was a true insight. And that if you collect enough of those, enough of that insight, it's almost like Bloodborne, I guess. Gonna say, yeah. Bloodborne. Yeah, if you collect enough insight, your awareness of the cosmic reality increases exponentially. I just hope you don't find any six-finger cockroach giants.
Don't play Bloodborne, guys. You'll have nightmares.
But anyway, more or less, that's what I was getting at. And that, to me, really dovetails into anime and animation and video games as well. Let's not shortchange. Because I feel like they are today's modern mythology that is being created as we speak and as we play. And I think that is really cool. Having gone and read every surviving piece of Greek and Roman mythology and almost all of the Greek tragedies and working my way, already read the Bible and the Quran and working my way up through the Middle Ages, you become aware of archetypes. They become almost like second nature. It's like an ancient TV tropes. That's really what it is. If you read all of this stuff, it's like going onto the ancient internet, which was preserved for you on stones and papyri, and you are getting a crash course in ancient archetypes. And so, just like going to TV tropes ruins you from enjoying, you know, ruins you from enjoying your media because you're just sitting there listing off all of the cliches and the stereotypes. Reading the ancient, you know, TV tropes, or I guess, you know, what would you even call it? Scroll tropes? Stone tropes? actually, far from destroying your enjoyment, actually increases your enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because the depth, these are the original archetypes that were later parodied and made into stereotypes.
Hmm.
So they're the originals, mm-hmm. you know? And so once you can realize the genius of the people who first came up with something. Yeah, it may be stale now, but it wasn't stale then. And what it meant to them, your enjoyment of current media increases exponentially. And you also begin to see the hidden connections of, like, if I had never read anything and I just watched this is just another anime. But if I've read the mythology, oh, this is the story of Hercules. This is the story of Pericles. This is the story of triumphing over monsters and, you know, becoming a monster to defeat a monster. Really common themes that people they'll mock or parody. Well, that's the Hydra blood. That's, you know, the warring of Hercules against his poisoned garment. you know, which is basically a metaphor for his lusts and his superhuman desires given to him by his wife that he cheated on, you know, so they tie in the whole relationship angle, you know, but that's all it is, you know, it's an ancient archetype. And to me, to see those ancient archetypes resurfacing spontaneously, I doubt all of these creators are sitting around doing what I'm doing, reading all this stuff, and they, let me craft this elaborate, you know, restatement.
Subconscious.
It's reemerging from the subconscious, but it's all happening around the same time. Like in the last 20 or 30 years, you can really see it with the advent of video games and anime taking off and being taken a little bit more seriously as an artistic medium. And that, to me, is kind of the ultimate place that I went to in my personal journey. Started out for fun, gave me a new perspective and intrigued me to dig a little deeper. And now that I actually went and dug deeper into the storytelling aspect, I'm really gaining a whole new perspective on what is going on in the world. Like, why now? Why is all this anime and all these video games being produced? Why are these particular stories being told now? And when you look at it that way, instead of just like some cool people made Bloodborne, some cool people made Metal Gear Solid 5, and they're unrelated, and you take a little bit more spiritual, I guess, approach to, does everything that happens have meaning, or is it chance? If you err on the side of it has meaning, there's some intent and planning, then you would have to ask the question, well, okay, why are these concepts being emphasized at this point in history? Why, as a worldwide society, are we recreating these ancient mythologies again? What are we longing for? What are we looking for? So, you know, being a Christian, I have a specific way that I would answer that. But even if you're not a Christian, the interesting thing about the archetypes is that they all do seem to lead back to a primordial concept. Usually the Isis, Osiris, Horus trinity of someone dying and being resurrected. And you see that with Hercules as well, overcoming labors, dying, and then being granted immortality among the stars. And that's kind of the thing. That's kind of the heroic story that everything comes back to. Many books have been written trying to, you know, point out similarities between Christ and more ancient stuff and saying, well, Christ is the Christian religion is just the furtherance of the ancient cults. And that is certainly one way to look at it. I look at it as it is the fulfillment and the culmination of a long series of foreshadowings in other cultures, and that Christ is indeed, you know, the hero to which the world looks forward in ancient times and looks back in modern times. But whether or not you agree with that, and the savior, I should say, not just the hero, but also the savior of mankind. But whether you agree with that or not, the mythological aspect purely as a story from the mind of a person can give you great insight into what your fellow humans care about and what across cultures people really care about.
What a deep note to end on.
I don't want to talk over you. I mean, want to comment on it? I didn't want to railroad you.
Well, no, I think that's a good place to end our main topic for the month. But one thing I do want to point out is just how you look at Sean, you look at me, you look at Tommy. Three very distinctly different people who all got into the same media for very distinctly different reasons with very distinctly different inputs. Yet we all share ultimately the same interest, and I'd say some of your points about archetypes too, even if we're not acknowledging them consciously, also have absolutely influenced the reason why we consume what we consume. So at that point, why don't we move on to listener mail?
Listener mail.
All right, well, for this month's listener mail, we have two questions. The first is from Sharkman Arcanum at sharkman-arcanum.tumblr.com. And Sharkman asks, what are some of the things we should know about etiquette in Japan? So this seems like a question tailor-made for JP. So I'm gonna let him answer it and then maybe bounce a few thoughts off of whatever his response might be.
You know, this is a pretty broad question. So there are some very specific answers, like not sticking your chopsticks into the bowl of rice because it looks like the Buddhist funeral ritual where they pass the bones. there are lots of things like that, just cultural faux pas. But it would take way too long to go through them, and I'm sure a quick Google search could answer them better than I could in this episode. But, you know, broadly speaking, which I think maybe is what you were looking for, is if you're in Japan, like, etiquette-wise, how does it differ from the West? I'd say, you know, in the Western world, I don't know where you're from, Sharkman Arcanum, but Western countries differ from country to country. But I'd say Japan, generally speaking, is much more formal. Much more interested in form over function, I think is the phrase that, best exemplifies Japanese culture and etiquette. You know, they're not so worried about maybe how qualified you are, as long as you are following the conventions of how qualified you look to be.
Do you think the honorific system in the language is an extension of that mentality?
Yeah, I would say that. And it's so, I mean, language translation is way harder than people think it is. If you've ever tried to actually learn a language that's very different from your own, like crossing the east and west line or learning an ancient language, it is really hard. And I have so much more respect for people like Bible translators or people who translate any ancient text at all.
Hebrew's a beast. Yeah. I did some amateur dabbling in Hebrew, and it took about 5 years of Latin. So Latin's actually not that hard of a language. But,
oh, really?
Yeah. Well, no one speaks it, so no one can tell you you're pronouncing anything wrong. You know, I guess unless you go to the Vatican.
Well, what Sean said, though, about the honorifics, I think is pretty tied into the language there. It is really different. I mean, we don't have all those honorifics. I mean, we have, what, sir, madam.
Dom. Yeah. Miss, yeah.
It's a lot of those we don't use anymore. They're archaic. But Japan uses all of them. I shouldn't say all of them. They have things like dono. Like, who the heck uses that anymore? That's like one lord speaking to another.
Yeah.
But they still use san, they still use kun, they still use sama, they still use...
Sensei. Let's not forget sensei.
Senpai. Kohai. Well, actually, if someone's calling you kohai, they're probably not going to tag that on because they don't respect you. Because they're younger. Or you're younger. Anyway, it's a really difficult question. It's hard to really answer it fully, but I'd say it's really different. Like, it's much more formal, and it's much more steeped in a very different culture than what we have here. I don't know how else to answer it.
Thus, Sharkman Arcanum, consult Google before visiting Japan.
Yes,
and putting
please.
Your chopsticks in the rice.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, actually, Sharkman Arcanum. So is that like the fish people of the ancient Babylonians that believed brought ancient knowledge to man? If so, that's clever. If not, you may have subconsciously produced an archetype in your username. All right, I'm done. The second question we have for this month is from Gas Explosion at the Scalpel Factory. I like your sense of humor already. At gasexplosionatthescalpelfactory.tumblr.com. And Gas Explosion at the Scalpel Factory asks, how do people in Japan feel about tall foreigners?
This is a very easy answer. They like them.
Well, I have not been to Japan per se. I have been to China, and I had the privilege of rooming with a very tall individual. He was about 6'5" and had blonde hair and blue eyes. And I can tell you that when we went to the all-girls communication school, he was a big hit, and many pictures were taken.
Yeah, I think Japan's starting to get over it a little bit because there are enough foreigners there and they have enough exposure to Western media. But, I mean, speaking as a relatively tall white individual, 6'3", and I'm blonde as well, I can say you still get some attention. I don't know if it's quite as much as some people might make it out to be, but it's also more than others might be expecting.
I did get called a white devil in rural China.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are you?
I wouldn't
devilishly
consider my,
handsome.
I wouldn't consider myself a devil.
All right. Well, that's going to about wrap up this episode of The Tangles. So if you enjoyed what you heard in today's interview, be sure to check out more of Tommy's work at animebowl.com. And as always, for more articles and media on the intersection of otaku culture and faith, check out beneaththetangles.com. Later, everyone.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of The Tangles, official companion podcast to BeneathTheTangles.com. Be sure to check out our full site for more articles and analyses on the intersection of otaku culture and faith. If you would like to submit a question, send an email to thetangles@outlook.com. Also, be sure to follow our Twitter, @AnimeTangles, and like our Facebook page, Beneath the Tangles, and rate and review The Tangles on iTunes. Featured opening and closing songs are Japanese Dream by Duke Ellington's Orchestra and Blue Piano Stomp by Johnny Dodds, available in the public domain. Again, thanks for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next time for The Tangles.